Dr. Harold Van Est, and he has co-authors Bianca Moebius-Clune, Rintaro Kinoshita, I'm sorry if I'm destroying your name, Robert Schindelbeck, Daniel Moebius-Clune, Aubrey Fine, and he'll be discussing the soil, the Cornell Soil Health Assessment Framework, a tool for restoring soil health. Dr. Van Es is a professor of soil and water management at Cornell University. He received degrees from the University of Amsterdam, Iowa State, and North Carolina State. He has a very tremendous resume, but he's being very humble here and sharing so little. But he is currently our president-elect of the Soil Science Society, and so this the success of this meeting is much to do with Dr. Van Es's work, and we thank you for that. Dr. Van Es.
Thank you, Ted, and thank you for your leadership on this. So as the program chair for soils for this year, I'm going to take a little time to compliment the people who figured out what this little ring is all about on the name tag. The idea is that you put it at the end and that you pull up your name tag a little bit, so when you close your jacket for the gentleman, that you don't cover up your name, and that if you sit at a table, that they can still see your name. Okay? So you don't have to do it now, but maybe discreetly when you go to the restroom next time, you can change the location of the ring. But you don't have to. But I felt like, as the program chair, I had the right to say that. Right? Okay, but the topic is soil health. And so I really appreciate Doug Carlin's introduction and the background on SMAF, because we built a lot of our assessment framework on SMAF, but decided that we wanted to focus more on the grower and on management. And SMAF was more designed initially as a research tool. At least I may misinterpret that. But we rolled it out almost 10 years ago now as a test, a soil health test that growers can pay for, or researchers, and they can get these results. And it identifies primarily soil constraints. We felt that that needed to be the emphasis, less emphasis on what's the overall quality or health of a soil, but where are the problems? Analogous to the traditional soil test where you say you have a low phosphorus value, and then you get a recommendation with that. 16 indicators that represent agronomically important soil processes. So it is an agriculturally focused soil health test, and we basically expanded the standard nutrient test. We took that as it was, and then we added physical and biological indicators, as you see here. We also interpret the values with scoring functions that Doug already introduced. We basically followed their lead on that. And then we now have, for the past 2 years, a fairly extensive report that the grower gets with their soil health report. We like colors. We buy crayons in very large quantities, and all the technicians try to stay within the lines on that. But they're doing a fantastic job. It's really remarkable. But you know, the philosophy is really, you don't know if you don't measure, or what gets measured gets done. And, you know, the traditional soil test, the nutrient pH test, is a tremendous success. You know, 50, 60 years of that, farmers know how to use it. They sample their soil, they send it in, maybe they have a consultant do it. They know how to interpret the numbers, they know what that 200 means something, that's high or low, and they know how to act on it, right? But they don't know that for aggregate stability or active carbon or other biological indicators, right? So that's what we need to do. We don't have to reinvent the wheel, right? Soil testing has been tremendously successful. So Doug mentioned functions, and functions are basically supported by processes. So what are some of these processes? For example, a physical process of aeration or root proliferation or storage or nutrient transformation. So there's a list here. You can probably add a few to it, but that's the basic idea, that in soil health testing that we look beyond the nutrients and the pH, but we also include physical and biological indicators that represent processes. And we attempted in the design of the test to be as inclusive and, as possible of all the relevant processes that or processes that are relevant for crop production. And so, for example, you see here as a physical indicator, aggregate stability. What are the processes that are related to that? Well, resistance to dispersal, aeration, infiltration, crusting, germination, rooting, runoff, and erosion. Okay, so these are all important processes, and we have an indicator that represents that. And so each of these indicators that you see here, so ag stability, available water capacity, hardness of the surface soil, hardness of the subsurface soil, and biological indicators, organic matter, active carbon, soil proteins, respiration, potential mineralizable nitrogen, a root rot bioassay, they all relate to various processes. And so we feel that we basically cover that pretty well. All the relevant processes should be covered in a comprehensive test. We can talk about how to simplify it later on. So those were the ones we selected. That was a process. In fact, it was a research project for Bianca Mobius-Kloon, who is now the director of the Soil Health Division. And so selecting those indicators, we need to do that with multiple objectives. So one of them is you want to make sure that these processes are represented. The other thing is it has to be practical. Okay? Certain indicators were not practical. For example, bulk density. We found that consultants and farmers were unable to give you good bulk density samples. It is because it has to be done very precisely with the rings and all that. So we said, okay, that's if they can't do it right, then let's not do it. And we found that basically aggregate stability was probably a better indicator anyway, so we didn't need to do bulk density anymore. It had to be affordable. You know, nobody wants to pay $250 for a soil health test. We had to keep the price under control. It had to relate to agronomic practices and management as well. So we were somewhat constrained, but this is what we decided on. And you could perhaps come up with slightly different indicators, but that's what we did. So in terms of sort of the logistics, once a sample comes to our lab and on our website, we have all kinds of directions on how to sample and where to sample and all that. And then we do some basic 8-millimeter sieving, and most of the soil then goes for the more biological analyses that where you don't want to destroy the integrity, the physical integrity of the soil, like wet aggregate stability or protein respiration, etc. And then another fraction basically gets crushed or sort of a standard grinding that then allows us to measure some of these other indicators. Okay, and actually in our department at Cornell, we're on 3 or 4 different floors in different labs where we are now pretty well set up. So I'll go over the indicators quickly. We start with the standard analysis. This was just the Cornell nutrient and pH test that we just incorporated. Okay, very simple. Everybody knows about that. We use an ICPES for most of those analyses. Soluble salts is an what we call an a la carte option. It's you have to pay for that separately. In most cases, you don't need it. But in some of the western areas where you have a salinity problem, or maybe with high tunnels where you sometimes have a salinity buildup, then you may want to have to pay a little extra for that. Here are the physical soil health indicators. We measure aggregate stability using a rainfall simulator. We've always been a little uncomfortable with the Yoder method, with the bathtub method. And so we know exactly how much energy, rainfall energy, we apply to the soil on the sieves, and we measure the fraction of stable versus unstable aggregates. The only field measurement is the penetrometer measurement, and we on our form we allow the user to enter that information, and we interpret that for them. We focus just on the surface and the subsurface and the highest value, and then the depth of the highest value. We measure texture in a rapid method. We primarily do that so that we can interpret the numbers, that we can interpret using the scoring curves. In the comprehensive test, we use this rapid settling method. And in the very basic test, which I'll talk about later, we just do the hand texturing, which is basically good enough. You know, is it a clay loam or a loam or whatever? And available water capacity is sort of the standard methodology for that, the pressure plates. The biological indicators, we use the active carbon, the permanganate oxidation. It's a great test. Ray Weil did a lot of work on that, and I think it's recognized as an important soil health test, and I'll come back to that later, actually. So you basically measured a fraction of carbon and nutrients in the total organic matter that's supposed to be sort of actually available for the soil food web. Although, it's an oxidation, it is a proxy, but it's pretty good. Microbial activity through respiration, also a very popular test. There's also commercial versions of it. We use Mason jars and KOH trap. Dan Mobius Kluhn kind of refined that, and using an EC meter. So it's a very inexpensive test to do it that way. And then the ACE soil protein index, again, that Dan did a lot of work on that. He worked with Janice Thies. And we have basically an inexpensive way to do that. Proteins, of course, are kind of an important part of the soil organic matter. It's where most of the nitrogen is, and that's basically subject to mineralization. So we felt that needed to be included. We didn't really have anything good on nitrogen until then. And then we have a root disease assessment. This is especially of value to vegetable growers. We actually started our first project working with vegetable growers. They have huge problems with soil-borne diseases. And this is sort of an integrative test. So we're not looking at a particular disease like Phytophthora or so. We're looking at, you know, what's the overall disease pressure. By doing a bioassay, we were growing snap beans in the greenhouse, and then we wash the roots after 4 weeks, and we do an assessment of the roots. And on the left is very healthy-looking roots, and on the right you can see a lot of disease pressure. So they just get a score. And that's work with George Abadwi, who's a plant pathologist. So going back a little bit to this issue of organic matter. So one of the things that we're actually finding very important is to look at organic matter quantity and quality. So when we look at, for example, organic matter, in this case of 5%, in our analysis, if we then look at the equivalent protein in that same sample, you can see there's a wide range. So the protein levels, milligrams per gram of soil, have a factor 3 or more difference. So we need to look not only at how much is the total organic matter, but what's the quality of that organic matter. So when we look at correlations among these indicators, we get a graph like this matrix here. And you might say, oh, that's not good. There's no correlations. This is actually good, because you don't want correlation. If you measure multiple indicators, if they're highly correlated, you don't need to measure multiple indicators. You can only need to measure one, right? So you don't want these to actually be correlated. And when you look at this, they actually aren't very well correlated. So there's a relatively high level of orthogonality with these indicators, which is good. So there's a reason why to measure them independently of each other, rather than just having one measurement and then by correlation assuming the others. So you do basically need that. And, you know, we sort of know our knowledge of soil science and agronomy tells us that some of these indicators are impacted by different things. Protein levels may be highly impacted by the presence of legumes in a rotation or cover crops or something like that. And that doesn't necessarily have something to do with the total organic matter or the active carbon, okay? So this is basically a good thing. So this is based on a little over 1,700 samples. So here's the typical report, at least the first page of the report. And, you know, we indicate the measured value. For example, available water capacity is 0.13 in this case. And then we interpret that with a scoring function, as Doug Carlin mentioned earlier. And then we use the color coding. And it's just an attractive way of presenting the information. Now what you see here, when you look at the physical, biological, and chemical indicators that were measured here, you see that on the bottom are the chemical indicators. and they're all in the green. So they're all good. And why is that? Because these growers have been measuring these chemical indicators for years, and they've acted on it. They've corrected the pH, they've added phosphorus and potassium, or corrected the micronutrient deficiencies, and we see that a lot. We see a lot of green with the nutrients and the pH, but we see often a lot of red and yellow with the physical and biological indicators because they have never been measured before. Okay? So this is the power of data. So again, the scoring function, so I can go over that pretty quickly now because Doug already covered that. We did follow their lead on that. More is better, less is better, or an optimum. And they can be adjusted based on texture or sometimes based on crop. For example, if it's blueberries versus alfalfa, with the pH, of course, that would make a difference. Some of them are, however, based on expert opinion. So, for example, pH we know a lot about, or phosphorus levels we know a lot about, a lot of research. So they are not based on a typical scoring function that Doug mentioned. They're based on the recommendation systems that have already been developed. But for the so-called newer indicators, like active carbon or protein, where we really didn't have any way to interpret those numbers, you know, because they hadn't been measured before, or very little. So is an active carbon value of 350, is that high or is that low? Okay. Well, the only way we could handle that is by looking at the population. So it's along the same lines as we use in medicine. For example, you have your blood test done, and they measure your potassium, and then they evaluate you relative to a larger population, you know, because they have thousands and thousands of measurements of potassium in the blood, and they know that you might be high or low or something like that. So that's basically the same idea. So it's a relatively simple methodology. So you basically, for most of these scoring functions, and again, this is the leading work from Doug and Susan and Cynthia, you have your distribution function, you define the mean and the standard deviation, very simple, we all know how to do that, and then all you do is you plug that same mean and standard deviation into a different function, which is the cumulative distribution function, and you can do this in Excel. Okay, it's very simple to do that, and with most of the indicators, we will separate out the different major textural classes, so coarse, medium, fine, because, for example, aggregate stability of 30% for a coarse textured soil is great, but for a fine textured soil is probably poor. Okay, so you do need to adjust for that, and that's why we measure texture. So, okay, going back to the report, at the bottom you see an overall quality score. We tend to de-emphasize that. We want to focus on where the constraints are, where the problems is, so that you can manage it. So, in terms of how do you use this information? And we actually made a mistake by believing that if we just give people a report like that, they would know what to do. Now, of course, they know what to do with sort of the traditional soil test, because if your P levels are low, then you can just plug it into a simple equation and it says, you know, 50 pounds per acre of phosphorus to be applied. But this requires a more holistic approach, and you have to put together a lot of information. So a lot of the consultants or extension agents we worked with struggled with basically working with the growers on how do you actually achieve some management changes. So we said, okay, we need to have basically a process. We need to help people sort of use this information and then make management decisions. So it was a four-step process, and then actually Bianca last year changed it to a six-step process to be a little bit more comprehensive. But basically, you start out by defining the context, the farm, the financial situation, their attitude to risk or change, all of those kind of things. And you set some goals, you sample for soil health, you submit the sample, you get the results back, and then you say, okay, you're going to prioritize. Where do I have most of the reds and the yellows? Okay, those are the areas that I need to prioritize. Then I need to identify good management options that will help solve these problems, these constraints. And then you create a management plan. A plan might be very specific. It might say, next spring, plant spring barley. with a and then a cover crop and then change tillage or whatever, or maybe even set the goal of going to a tillage conference to learn about, say, reduced tillage practices. And then in the end, of course, you implement and monitor, and then you kind of go back to number one. So we in the reports, it's now an 8-page report, we actually really try to help the user interpret these numbers. Okay, so this is just a snippet of that for aggregate stability. It explains what aggregate stability is and what it measures and why it's relevant. You know, these are all electronic reports, so it doesn't matter. You know, you're not wasting paper to do this. We just want to be as comprehensive as possible. And then we at the bottom it says your measured aggregate stability value is 22.5%, corresponding to a score of 26 out of 100. And this is low, and therefore you may want to try to address this. Okay? So we try to help the user as much as possible. Then also with the report, they get this table with suggested management practices. So if you have, say, low aggregate stability, then you have some short-term and some long-term management practices. Now what you'll see is that some of these management practices help address multiple constraints. So if you have red since, say, aggregate stability and an active carbon, then you might find some management practices that address both and say, okay, well, that's one. That would be probably a high-priority management practice. Unfortunately, we can't sort of say, can't give you a recipe of you have this problem, here's your solution, like you have with traditional soil testing. It is a little bit more sophisticated, and it requires putting together multiple concepts. So just to show you the what we're offering currently, so the standard package is basically $95. Then we have a basic package that we started a couple of years ago because some people don't want to spend $95. And then we have a more comprehensive one that's a little bit more expensive. So the basic package is basically your standard Cornell nutrient analysis package plus wet aggregate stability and soil respiration. And then, of course, the penetrometer measurements are actually made in the field, so that's no cost to us. We just help with the interpretation. And the standard package, which is the one that I showed you the report from, is $95, and that then adds a number of indicators. Thank you. And then the comprehensive package is if you want to pay more, say you want to have soluble salts or you want to have the root disease analysis or heavy metals in certain conditions, you may want to do that. Okay, so there's been a lot of discussion in the past year about, well, what's the best way to offer a low-cost test. All right, so what we did, we have a lot of analyses done. So we're able to do what's called a best subsets regression. So we have the overall soil quality score, and this indicates which of the indicators does the best job of predicting that overall quality score with just a single indicator or two indicators or three. Okay, so active carbon is actually the best predictor of overall soil health. Okay, in fact, an R-square, just R-square of 51%. So you can actually, with just a single measurement of active carbon, you can actually do a pretty good job of assessing overall soil health. Respiration is lower, 44%. If you're willing to make two measurements, then you can either do active carbon plus respiration, it gives you 61% R-square, pretty good. Or aggregate stability and active carbon gives you 58, so it's just slightly less. The latter, I think, is preferable because that's one physical indicator and one biological indicator. So it appears that if you want to simplify the test and you say you want to do a standard chemical test and you want to measure one physical indicator and one biological indicator, it appears that aggregate stability and active carbons would be your choice. Okay, I want to show a little bit also about whole profile soil health because we focus so much on the surface layer. That's where a lot of the biological activity is. That's where we have, of course, a lot of the nutrients. But the soils, the crops require the subsoil, especially for water. And so we have the surface soil, we have a transition layer, and then we have the subsoil. And one of my students went to a very well-established tillage experiment where we had no-till and plow-till, and we had, within these, we had no-till with the stover returned, no-till with the stover harvested, and plow-till returned and harvested. Now, as you know, when you plow, you kind of move that organic matter from the surface, that residue, down to the bottom of the plow layer. Right? That's what you do, and then the next year, you might kind of mix it back in. With no-till, of course, you don't have any mechanical way of incorporating organic matter, but you have maybe biological ways. Roots and exudates, bioturbation, and dissolved organic matter via preferential flow. So the question is, how does tillage impact soil health in the subsoil? And so I'm going to show you some data here. So this is different tillage, different depths, 0 to 6 centimeters, 6 to 18, all the way down to 60 centimeters. And so this is the surface soil, the plow layer. This is that transition layer, and this is the subsoil. And I'm using color coding. We love color coding. Blue is best, then green, then orange, then red. And what you see in the surface soil for these different biological indicators, clearly the no-till, where you return the stover, you don't remove the stover, you have the best soil health. And then second, no-till, where you remove the stover, then the plow-till, and where you return the stover, and then the plow-till harvested being the worst. And it's very consistent in the surface layer. You can see the colors. In the transition layer, where you, of course, place some of that organic matter, you have a mix, and it actually matters more on how much stover you return. But then, interestingly, when you go into the subsoil, we return back to the no-till situation being best. So that means that the effects of no-till translate all the way into the subsoil. And some of these indicators are almost double for no-till stover returned than, say, for plow-till. Probably most of that is bioturbation. But it's very interesting to see that we see benefits of no-till way into the subsoil, which is very exciting. Okay, summary then of the test, measure constraints, process and function focused, physical, biological, chemical, nonlinear scoring functions, as discussed earlier, basic standard comprehensive test, a la carte options, management recommendations, and a decision process. So with that, I think we did all right. Thank you.
We have one quick question right down.
JK, yeah.
Please repeat it.
Yes, we do actually have some information. Bianca did some work in Kenya that demonstrated that, and we did some work in Israel recently. It's very difficult to do, but we do find some correlation. But, you know, it's not 0.95 R squared kind of stuff. Yep.
Thank you very much, Dr. Van Ness.